All right, this is really two questions, but they're so related. I wanted to do them together tonight from Luke 8 and verse 25 and Luke 8 verse 28. One group, the first part of it is asked by disciples. The last part of it is asked by demons. But it really is simply the two sides of the same coin. It's not as different as it may appear on the surface. It involves two quite different events. One is the stilling of the waves and the wind and the storm at sea. And the other is the setting free of a man who has been possessed by a legion of terrible demons, and his life has been wrecked, and he has been out of control and unpresentable during this period of time. They look so different, and yet if you look at Luke chapter 8, they're a part of a series of events that seem to me to have an especially important purpose. There are four miracles of Jesus here. There is the stilling of the storm, then the casting out of these demons from the man in the tombs, and then the raising of Jairus' daughter and the healing of the woman that we studied about this morning, those latter two. And that's followed in the beginning of Luke chapter 9 by the mission of the 12 when the Lord sends them out. So these must be wonders that help prepare the Lord's servants for ministry. There is something about these miracles here that are especially important if people who belong to Christ are going to be able to fulfill their work for Him. And if we think about them that way, I think it'll be a blessing to us. These two miracles have some things that are sort of uniquely similar about them. On the one hand, both of them are things that involve things that don't occur in other places in the Gospel of Luke. This first one, the stilling of the storm, is something that happens because Jesus is serving the interest or doing a blessing upon the disciples who are with him. Usually these men are involved with him in serving, and he helps them to do things for other people. In this case, however, when they cry out, he blesses them and not somebody else. You know, you stop and think about it. The Lord's people need Christ to minister to them as well as helping them minister to other people. And if we don't have the idea that, as Jesus said in the Great Commission, I'm with you always, then we collapse under the weight of our programs and our activities and our efforts to try to bear fruit by ourselves. The other one of these miracles is unique also in that this is in the only case in the Gospel of Luke where Jesus does these mighty things in predominantly a Gentile territory or Gentile setting. Depending on whether we're talking about the Gadarenes or the Gergesenes, the two different words that are used in the two different gospel records. One of them involved a town about 6 miles to the southeast of the Sea of Galilee, and another one involved a town about 30 miles to the southeast of the Sea of Galilee, and either term may refer to the whole area. And that's where Jesus is when he cast the demons out of the man who is here. So in one case he is serving the interests of his closest disciples. In the other case, he's serving the interests of the people who don't know much about the God of Israel. And in that way, they're alike. And then, in one way of looking at this, both of these things involve really is sort of exorcism If you think of it that way, we like to talk about these miracles as if the first one involves the Lord's power over the laws of nature, and the other one involves the Lord's power over the spirit world. Someone I read observed that really people didn't think about these things being laws of nature until the scientific age. They were more likely to think about what God was doing and giving rain or and withholding rain and that sort of thing, or the wind. And if you notice, when Jesus deals with it, he just commands the wind and the water to do this or that. In Mark, he rebukes the wind and the waves, like you would rebuke a demon or command the demon to come out. And if you consider then his dealing with the man in the possessed state, just like he sends out the turmoil in the one case, he does so in the other case as well. So think of it in that way. And now, in order to try to not deal with every detail in either story, but still to see some of the parallels in both that lead to these two questions, we might think of it this way. Both of these stories start with fear. Both of these episodes start with something that involves fear. And in Luke 8, verse 22, beginning, they're crossing from the west, or from one side of the Sea of Galilee, from the west side to the east side of the sea. And as they do so, the Lord falls asleep on a cushion in the front of the boat. And the windstorm comes down through the cliffs and the ravines and the steep banks around the Sea of Galilee and falls down on it, and the water begins to churn and the waves begin to rage, and it all causes the boat to begin to fill with water so that they are in danger. And verse 24, they wake Jesus saying, "Master, Master." In what circumstances would you repeat someone's name twice or address someone with the same term twice? You can see the panic or the urgency in this. We're perishing. The parallel records suggest that they raised the question, "Don't you care that we're perishing? Why are you not bothered?" You can tell that they're alarmed. They're frightened. The boat's filling up, and our lives depend on this boat. So there is fear here. And the other situation, you notice in verses 26 and following, in this Gentile territory on the opposite side of the Sea of Galilee, they step out on the land, verse 27, and there met him, a man from the city who had demons. Now, I don't know what time of the day this is, but usually when you get out of a car or a boat after having made a trip, you want to kind of stretch and relax and get your bearings a little bit. And if you can imagine, you step out of the boat onto the land and you meet this guy. And that's not all about him that we're told here. If you notice, it says that he had for a long time worn no clothes. Well, that would have a certain impact, I would think. He had not lived in a house, but among the tombs. You don't like to visit the graveyard under ideal situations, and this isn't one of those. And then a little bit later, Luke explains at the middle of verse 29, these demons for many a time had seized him, and he was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. So I would say if you were met by a person like that, you have kind of a shock. There's something uncomfortable about this. This is not the kind of company you want to keep or to be in. So in both these circumstances, we begin with fear. In both of them, next, we meet up against the authority of Jesus. In both cases, the authority of Jesus is a blessing. In both cases, the people who are in the circumstance in which fear dominates have reason to be grateful for the presence of someone with the kind of authority that Jesus has. So in the first case, in verse 24, beginning about halfway through, he awoke and he rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased, and there was a calm. In Mark, the rebuke is, "Peace, be still." And in Mark, there is not only a calm, but a great calm. I wonder what a great calm sounds like. When Kay and I were first married, we lived in West Texas. And in West Texas, I got my first experience of a dust storm. Be real honest with you, I didn't prefer that sort of circumstance. These terrible storms, they blow, the dust goes everywhere. You can't get in a place where it doesn't get to you, and the weeds blow along with it, and it gets dark and all that. The next day would always be wonderful. Clear and calm and quiet. And I've thought if you could squeeze that together in a short space, you might get a picture of what happens here. The Lord could rebuke. I'm told it's the word that was used to speak of putting a muzzle on a dog. The Lord could tell the wind and the sea to shut up and calm down, and it would. In the other case, this man is possessed by demons that have control of him. It's not simply to be thought of as mental illness or as an ancient superstition of such. This is actually a case where there was a man possessed of demons. And the demons, the demon possession phenomenon, I have a theory. My theory is that during the periods when God is actively working miracles, when he opens the window to do miracles, the devil uses the window too and can be active in that way. And that people's lives suffered from this kind of thing. And Jesus has been commanding the demons to come out of this man when they fall down before him. Remember how Jairus fell down before him this morning? They fall down before him and they say, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High? I beg you not to torment me." The commentators say there was a superstition that if a demon could say someone's name, then that demon would have the possession or would have control over that person. And the idea would be if these demons could say in the name of Jesus and say who he was, then somehow or another they could tell him what to do. Of course, I don't see anything like that in this case. Jesus asked, what's your name? Verse 30. And he said, "Legion." The reason being that many demons had entered him. A legion, a Roman legion, was 4,000 to 6,000 soldiers. If there's a whole battalion of demons possessing this man, you can tell what sad circumstance he's in. Now, here's the question. Can they tell Jesus what to do, or can he tell them what to do? Well, it ends up being the latter. They get sent into a herd of pigs. The Lord gives them permission, and they're destroyed, as if to say to any, to that whole Gentile area here, this man has really been set free, and Jesus really can control the people. So we move from fear to authority, and in the third place, both of these stories have in common peace, relief or restoration. When Jesus has stilled the storm and there was a calm, there is the opportunity for the disciples to hear him say to them, "Where's your faith?" Later on, he'll ask them, "What's your faith? Who do you say I am?" But here, you can see he is in the process of helping their faith grow. And he is dealing with the storm like this. He means not only to save their lives, but to help them evaluate the level of their confidence in Jesus. There is a certain peace that they ought to be in possession of that he wants them to see. On the other hand, the man who's been possessed by demons is so different after this. This fella who was in the terrible condition we described, if you look down to verse 35, people go out to see what's happened, and they come to Jesus and they find the man from whom the demons have gone sitting at the feet of Jesus rather than running wild in the tombs. He's now clothed rather than being unclothed and unpresentable. He's in his right mind as opposed to being completely possessed. And in every way that we could measure by usual standards, this fellow he's been changed by what the Lord has done for him. So look at the line of thought: fear, authority, peace, and what would you think would come next? Do you know what does come next in both stories? Greater fear. And that's the strange thing, isn't it? Lest we think that these stories of Christ and what he did are simply sentimental, sweet things that sort of soothe the troubles in our lives, you look at how the people are in the presence of Jesus. In verse 25, it says, and this is after the calm and the Lord's question about their faith, and they were afraid, and they marveled, saying to one another, "Who then is this that he commands even winds and water, and they obey him?" Now, unspoken here is the fact that these men would have known there is a scriptural answer to that question. In passages like Psalm 107 and verse 29 and at least four of the other Psalms and at least once in Acts, it makes the point that the one who tells the wind and the wave things and they obey him is God. So the fear that they are experiencing here is fear of a certain kind. The fear of a mortal being who recognizes that he or she is in the presence of the eternal God. How does that kind of fear strike a person? Who is this? And what does he have to do with me? I would think that there would be the feeling in a person's life, Maybe I ought to be listening to him too. Maybe I can trust him. Maybe I should be obeying him in my life. And then what about the man in the tombs a little bit later in the chapter? We would think that that story all had a wonderful ending and that everyone would be so moved with joy at the change that has come about in this man's life. But if you look down, it says these people who came out to Jesus and saw this man like this and how he had been healed in verse 37, they're followed by all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes who ask him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. The fellow had been often seized by these demons, but now they're the same word, seized with great fear. Why? Why had they not been afraid when the man was running wild in the tombs? And now they're afraid when he's sitting clothed in his right mind at the feet of Jesus. One possibility is that before they knew where the man with the evil, the problem with evil was. He could be allowed to sort of deal with it himself off there in the tombs, and they could go about their lives and their businesses in town and so forth, and everything would be all right. We can get used to living alongside of evil as long as it doesn't disturb us in the process. And that seems to be, to me, what's happened with these folks. They haven't answered the question that was first raised by the demons. What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? He was someone who would have been willing to deal with the evil in a way that would bless the population, but they did not want their economic circumstances or their habits disturbed. They were afraid. They asked Jesus to leave. What did he do? He left. That seems to be the way he is. And this is, again, one of the only case that I can find in Luke where this happens. And it's sort of like he went over to the far country and he blessed a man's life, and the far country asked him to go back home. The man wanted to go with Jesus, but Jesus instead told him to return to his home and declare how much God had done for you. Do you notice that? In that Gentile area, this was a way for Jesus, for the story of the true God and his power to be made known. And it says the man went away proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. Isn't that interesting? That might answer the question for us, both of who he is and what he's done, what he is to me. He's the Son of God, and he has put me in my right mind and dealt with the evil in my life and sent me to do something for him. These Sunday nights we're trying to look at questions that are important questions of life. Last week we did the "What is your life?" question on Sunday morning, if you remember, and then we dealt with the "Are you greater than our father Abraham?" This is one of the most basic questions of all. Who is Jesus? And what does he have to do with me? The first one he answers. Second one, We need the answer, the second part of it. We need the answer. Is he a problem for me to be afraid of and try to get away from? Or is he so much greater than me that my reverence for him could bring a calm in my life if I let it? We'll come a few chapters over to the time when Jesus says, "All right, who do you say that I am?" And that will have its roots in this question right here. I appreciate you studying along with us tonight. I hope we leave impressed with Christ, and that we meditate on these questions. If you're here tonight and you thought that this is the time you would choose to be to make the good confession and to be baptized into Christ, we'd rejoice to get to see that happen. If you're here and there are things on your heart and mind that need to be prayed about by your brothers and sisters, of course, that's why we're together as well. And we'd love to help if you'll let us know by coming while we stand and sing a song.